Okay, fasten your psychological seatbelts. You're in for a ride on this, baby. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your loving host. Call me Fred Flintstone. No. That's probably copywritten. Never mind. Call me Todd Conklin. I'm here to help you. Well, today's a big day, and they always kind of are. But, you know, I've been getting a lot of requests to talk more about investigations, tell us more about investigations. And so I got a chance to do it. I was at the HPRCT conference. And for those of you that went, thank you. It was super fun seeing you. Sorry about my wardrobe. You know, the airline lost my luggage. So I should probably talk about this for a moment because it's kind of a big deal. I don't know if you've ever had lost luggage with the airline before. I have a couple times. I live to tell the story. This one was different. The airline lost my luggage, and in fact, it was carry-on. So there you go. I lost my carry-on luggage. So when I said that, because I just had to wear shorts and kind of a shirt at the HPRCT when I did the opening speech, and I think I looked pretty much like crap because that's all I had, because I didn't have any clothes, because I got in super late, because the plane was really late, super late, and I didn't have time because I can't just go anywhere and buy clothes. Like, it's not like that. So I had to go with what I had. And I told them I lost my luggage and it was carry-on luggage. And I think everybody thought it was a joke. But it wasn't a joke. I swear it wasn't a joke. If you've ever ridden on those little regional jets, those Embraer RJs, they call them, little tiny, teeny planes that they use to connect to the big planes. I was on one of those little tiny planes. And when you roll up to the gate, they put a little tag on your bag, and it's called a gate check tag, and you give it to the nice man, and he scans it with his nice scanner, and then they go away. I always assume they put it in the back of the plane. That seems what happens. Then when you land, you wait a couple minutes, and voila, it's there at the door, right where you left it. Well, different airport, but right where you left it, you pick it up, and everything's great. The picking up everything is great part did not work well for me. They found it the last day of the conference, literally the last hours of the last day of the conference. You could write it down. That's why I said literal. And so I pretty much had the same clothes I always had pretty much the entire time. I did stop and buy some new things like unmentionables. I've got some of those and a shirt or two. But I continued to wear shorts the entire conference, which, quite honestly, I was the only one, but I think I was most comfortable. So anyway, that was the big deal. Well, at this HPRCT conference, I got a chance to sit down and interview Bob Nelms, whom I really like. Totally dig him. He's a total digging guy. He's very cool. And he has a company called Failsafe Network. And you can just find it at failsafenetwork.com. I mean, it's pretty easy to find. And Bob does a lot of what he calls root cause analysis, which, if you know me, I'm not in love with that phrase at all. In fact, I think it's kind of a backward phrase, and that's going to come up a lot in this podcast. So let me just warn you, we don't come to peace with that, but it's a very cordial discussion around the notion of root cause analysis, or what I would call event explanation or operational learning or event learning. I can think of a million better words than root cause analysis, but I had to be polite because that's my job. Bob did a great job. He is a nice, nice, nice man, just as sweet as pie. You kind of want to hang out with him, and he's got a lot of expertise in this area. It was a great conversation. I can't wait for you to listen to it. So sit back and enjoy the Pre-Accident Podcast. It's an investigation one for all you guys. You've heard the story of my luggage. I don't know what else to tell you other than maybe I'll talk to you a little bit on the backside of this podcast. But until then, here, my friends, is Bob Nelms. The one thing I think we share is that you and I clearly communicate that failure is normal and that failure is important and that failure is not the opposite of success. It's actually a really important component of success. That's actually pretty controversial in our business, as you know. What led you to that idea?
Does anybody ever tell you anything that makes you go in the opposite direction? Maybe I'm a little bit of a rebel. If somebody tells me, you don't, well, maybe we all are. Somebody tells a kid, don't touch that over there. They're going to go and touch that over there. Well, like I said in my talk today, very early in my career, people told me, if you really want to make a difference, you don't focus on failure. You focus on success. That's what everybody's interested in. And that just stuck in my craw. I don't know why.
It's true. I mean, it's true. I was in a meeting the other day, and there was a giant sign that said, do not touch this switch. I absolutely touched it. Because that's a part of it.
Yeah.
So introduce yourself. Tell people why you're the most interesting man in the world. And you kind of are, Bob. You're like the Dos Equis guy.
Is this edited?
Yeah, we can edit it.
Okay. I talked to Brian Hughes at lunchtime. You know Brian Sologic? He's one of the Sologic principals, and he's here. He's going to be talking.
Oh, cool.
And he told me that he is an accountant, and he is in this business, in the root cause analysis business, and he does root cause analyses on all kinds of high-tech stuff, and he's an accountant because he knows how much he doesn't know, and he embraces it. He accepts it.
Yeah.
So when you ask me to introduce myself and help and tell everybody how interesting you are, I don't know if I want to think like that, because I don't even know if I am. Most of, I don't know why people hire me. I really mean this. I tell this to my wife all the time. The very people who are paying money for me to live are the people who won't do what I've been suggesting. Why do people ask for things that they're not going to want and keep asking and asking and asking? I don't understand all of that.
Well, let's be on that. Why do you think they do it? I mean, what's your feeling? You've clearly chewed this question around a while. What do you think? I'll tell you my answer, but you first.
I'm not sure. I've chewed it around, but I don't know if I ever landed on an answer. People want to do, they want to appear like they're doing the right thing. It's like Stephen Covey. Everybody, a lot of people were into Stephen Covey way back when. And that appeared that the companies who embraced that were doing the right thing. But if you go a couple of notches below the people who brought Stephen Covey in, they were inflamed about the Stephen Covey stuff because it ain't ever going to happen here. They don't really mean that. So maybe the same thing happened with Stephen Covey that's happening with what I do. I don't know. What is your answer? Why do people do that?
So I think there's a couple things. One is I think people really believe they want to know the truth until they get the truth. And then what they want to know is what's convenient and what's easy. The other thing is that I think people truly believe at some level that the problem is that employees need to be fixed. And I think that shift that's going on right now, where we don't see really employees as a problem to fix, we start to see employees as a resource to be tapped, right? I mean, that's a huge underpinning for almost everything you say. That shift is really, really important, but management doesn't know what to do with it, because we're asking managers, leaders, owners, business presidents, senior VPs, we're asking them to actually become accountable to some level for what the investigation might find, and that there's a shared sense of accountability. And it's much easier when they could say, I need to fix them, when in reality what we're saying is, it's not them, it's all of us, and that accountability is really a partnership. That's my guess.
But they already know. Why would they bring me in, knowing the message that I bring, that it isn't just the guy down there, that it's all the way up the chain,
right?
It's all of us.
Right.
They know that when they bring me in, and yet they bring me in.
So how much time do you get to spend with the senior leaders?
That's an interesting question. In the early days, up until maybe 5 years ago, hardly any with the senior leaders. Now, it's almost always starts with the senior leaders. But there's a problem there, too, because the senior leaders who bring me in, this just happened. An executive vice president brought me in, fully embraced this, drove it down his organization's throats, and his leadership didn't like it, and they fired the senior executive vice president. And now everything that, you know, for the last 6 years, everything we've been doing up there, going away.
Yeah. So, except that, what do you think about the idea that once you introduce your ideas into an organization at any level, the one thing that I think is really powerful is you can never unlearn something.
Oh, definitely.
So even by just going there, you're doing kind of a pretty robust intervention into the organization.
Well,
right?
I agree with that. I'm thinking now of something that I told some affiliates that I had 10 years ago, and I know you agree with this. We're not here to help corporations. We really aren't. We're not here to improve safety performance, although we will. We're not here to do any of that. We're here to help people. At a very fundamental, basic level, help people. And no matter where they go for the rest of their life, they're going to carry around something that they might not have carried around before.
I don't like the word cause because it's linear and normative, and it makes everything look like a mechanistic failure. And most of the failures I deal with are more adaptive. What do you think? Am I wrong?
No, but I've heard you don't like the word cause. I've heard you don't like the whole concept of root cause analysis, or you don't appreciate it like some other people do.
I don't. So, to be honest, I mean, I think root cause analysis is very, it's dangerous almost. It's almost, the term root cause analysis, I'm not talking about what you do. I'm talking about what the world calls it. Because the notion that there's one cause, monocausality.
Hardly anybody thinks that anymore.
Except the word is root cause. It's not root cause. I mean, I guess the plural of root is root. I don't really know what the plural of root is, but I think it telegraphs to managers the fact that there's one thing that if we fixed it, it would make it better. I know that you don't believe that.
I honestly think that 80% of the folks out there, 95% of the folks out there that we deal with don't think that. They don't think there's one root cause. They just don't. That's a really naive way of looking at life.
Why do they do such crappy investigations?
So you go into a grocery store and you can buy Wheaties or oatmeal or all this variety of
Captain
stuff.
Crunch. Don't forget right. Captain
okay,
Crunch.
Okay, Captain Crunch, all this variety. And you say, I like that one. And they pick that one and they use that for root cause analysis. So why do they even do root cause analysis? Because they think that this is the answer to their problems. We need to focus on systems. And this technique right here will focus on systems, so that's the one we're going to use. This one over here totally focuses on management. I don't know. But another client is going to go in there and they're going to look around and they say, we don't need systems. Our systems are fantastic. Our managers, we need to focus on this. We're going to pull that one off the shelf. But no matter which one you pull off the shelf, nobody is saying it's just one manager or one system. It's always, I really think that almost everybody would accept it's never one root cause.
Yeah, but I'm not sure we want to know a cause. I think what we want to know is an explanation. Like, explain to me how this happened. And cause insinuates like that somebody caused this to happen. What they probably did was trigger an event, but the causes, they're sort of constructed.
I cause problems. This is, well, I don't know, we might. I don't know. If we disagree on this, it would be kind of healthy.
Oh, it's better.
Yeah, right. But I know I cause problems. And the more I look at myself, the more I know I'm a walking problem causer. Me.
Right.
Okay? I wish everybody would know that the same thing about themselves. Wouldn't the whole world be better?
Yeah, except that cause implies choice. Do you choose to cause problems?
If I look back, maybe I made the wrong choice in pushing that glass over. So does cause always imply choice? Not always, you know that. Sometimes there's no choice, it's just an automatic reflex, you know. I just bumped a piece of paper. So I don't know where you're going with that.
Well, so let me put it this way, that the problem with cause really is that it's different retrospectively after the event happens, after there's consequence, a pain's happened, a bad thing's happened. It's different retrospectively than it is prospectively or in context. And I think it's easy after an event happened to desperately search for the cause of the failure. So I ask this question all the time. Why do people fall down? Well, the cause for people falling down is gravity, right? It's physics.
Well, there's nothing useful. I don't know if there's anything useful in that comment.
I think it's complete. It's correct. It's incomplete, but it's okay. Correct, right? Mm-hmm. But we sort of do the same thing. Or we is kind of a damning statement. Organizations do. The challenge I have is that I'll go and look at investigations of all levels, big, small, you know, fat, skinny, and they all have pretty much the same findings. Worker failed to, management failed to, you know, right? That doesn't strike me as very meaningful and not very causal. But where I'd push you is it also is very linear in retrospect to, like, create a timeline.
I wish there was a way where in a short period of time I could convey to you how we do what we do. What we do is so different than anything that you've ever seen.
Tell me about it. Tell me.
Well, something goes wrong.
Right. Normal. That happens all the time.
Evidence is gathered.
Got it. When you say evidence is gathered, what do you mean?
People are we listen to people.
Yeah.
It depends on what the incident is.
Yeah, totally.
Physical, if it's a physical event, then there's physical evidence, paper evidence. The three Ps, people, physical, and paper evidence. We always go after the three Ps. Once the evidence is gathered, there's an attempt to make sure the right people see that evidence. And it's never one person. It's always many people. So the right people, here's the evidence right here. And there's 15 people sitting around looking at the evidence. And they're the right people who need to look at that evidence.
Right.
You ask those people, like I said in my presentation today, we had a physical event here. Here's the evidence. How did it happen? And we have a way for them to come to consensus on how it happened. And it's got to be based on that evidence. So they define how it happened. Once everybody agrees on how it happens, we ask these 15 people or whatever, who did what wrong that allowed or enabled those physics? You have to say who. You have to say what they did. And whatever they did has to be wrong in retrospect.
So I'm not going to give you...
Wait.
Oh, please.
One,
yeah.
One more point. You're the only person that you're allowed to, in quote, write up when you're answering who did what wrong is yourself. So we have 15 people sitting around, and I've never done one of these where every one of the 15 people don't write themselves up at least once. So in terms of linear, there goes your linearity right there. We have 20 things that people did that they all self-identify contributed to whatever it is that went wrong. Now, there's a couple of other steps, but I interrupted you.
No, I was just going to say, I completely think your use of who did what wrong is beautiful. I mean, I have to tell you, the wrong part to me is not bad because error is so normal that it's never causal. It's always going to be conditional, and it's super normal. And the way I fight that is, every time they're successful, people still did wrong things, right? I mean, they do just as many wrong things when they don't injure people or ruin equipment as they do when they do injure people and ruin equipment. So we pretend, not us, but I think the world pretends that somehow the wrong becomes a causal trigger, but it's not. It's just what happened in the conditions. But that's a very mature way to ask companies to think about it, because companies basically want to know who screwed up, what should I do with them, and how can I assure it'll never happen again? There's a lot of pressure to fix. Pressuring to fix dramatically outweighs
now
the pressure
to
analyze.
I have a question for you, because
yes, sir.
I agree with everything that you said, but the most disturbing part of your talk today came in the first 10 minutes of your talk when you told those stories.
Right.
You were telling stories about the place you worked at.
Yeah.
Work at.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a significant influence on any organization. And the place that you work at did that?
Yeah.
Then what hope is there for anybody else?
Oh, but it's step by step, moment by moment. So change is a dish, I think, that comes slowly. And that people have to, we have to build them a bridge. So, Bob, the thing you have to remember is you've been thinking about this for 40 years. In many ways, you're 40 years ahead of the people that are in your class. Or let me take that back. You're definitely 40 years ahead of the managers you talk to, the senior leaders, EVPs, those kind of people. What's just natural for you, just natural. I mean, it's the way you've seen the world for 40 years is actually new for them. So what I try to remember is that I build an arc towards maturity and that they'll drift back. But what's important is when they drift back, they learn from that failure as well, right? And so when they drift back, we self-correct and say, well, I had a lady ask me this morning, she said, you know, my boss is really blame. There's a lot of blame. And she said, I don't know what to say to them. And I said, well, to me, the best thing you could say is after they discipline an employee post-event, let the smoke settle for a while and then ask this question, what did we fix? And she looked at me and I said, you probably have to ask it 10 times. But ultimately, what you want to get them to is the understanding that when you discipline an employee, you get the emotional satisfaction of punishing the bad actor, but you don't get the technical and operational knowledge actually fix the problem.
I'm totally with you. I'm with you, you know, 99% of everything that you say. Like I said today, I felt like jumping up and down most of the time in your talk. I guess the issue that I wish we could come closer on is the value of these. Actually, it's the only value. The only true way to learn is in retrospect.
Well, it's the only way you can learn.
Right.
The problem is with retrospect, my biggest problem with retrospect, not yours, but my biggest problem with retrospect is that in retrospect, error looks like a choice. And in context, mistakes are mistakes. They're unintentional. I didn't mean to knock the glass over. I mean, you meant to knock that glass over. But had you moved your elbow and knocked the glass over and it got on your computer, right? I bet you in retrospect you'd say, I wish I wouldn't have moved my elbow. I should have not had the computer on the table. I should never put a glass of water by the table, right? Those are all really significant learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. The problem is we color those learning opportunities ultimately with this bias, and the bias is I screwed up. Now, I like how you say, that's a starting place, not the stopping place. I hate how managers use it as a stopping place. As soon as they figure out the mistake was Bob put a glass of water on the table, therefore we're going to ask Bob to never put water on the table, and we're going to make a policy that says no water on the table. When in reality, it's a much more interesting problem if you think, wow, all the conditions were there to cause this pain, right? And what we manage are the conditions.
And one manager recognizes that he's partially responsible for those conditions being there. And another supervisor recognizes they're partially responsible for this. I really think you got to drive it back to that, to people seeing themselves.
So let me ask the million-dollar question. Why? Why do you care so much about this?
Really good question. I don't know. It's a calling. It's a. My wife asks me, why don't you retire? I want to be with you longer. I want to be around you more. Not until I see this thing continue. It's a calling. Why do I care? I know something other people don't know. And I know it. I know it in every cell of my body. We are the problem. We humans are the problem. Everything that goes right is because of us. Everything that we see right now is there because of us. That means everything that goes wrong is because of us. It's just that we're too busy doing this, pointing at other things and people and even systems, or even blaming systems, that we can't see us. I don't want to call myself a religious man, because religious man these days means something rigid and all that stuff. But I certainly am a spiritual man. And there's a deep spiritual truth to this. Look at what's going on in the world today. Look at what's going on in the United States today. Everybody's pointing their freaking finger at everything and everybody else, all over the world. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody stopped that and looked at themselves? So that's the bottom line message to me and everybody that's working with me is that we got to stop doing this and get out the mirror. Easy. One other thing. Action-reaction world. We live in an action-reaction world. If I point my finger at you, you're going to point your finger at me. If I look at myself, you're going to be much more inclined to look at yourself. That's how it works with my wife and I. When I used to point my finger at her, she used to point it right back. When I lead and say, look at how I screwed up again, she says, well, come on, Bob, it wasn't all you. I did this. So it's so easy. This stuff is easy.
I don't know how easy I would call all this stuff, but I thought that was an amazing interview. Just a great conversation to have with Bob Nelms. I really appreciated the chance to just sit and talk with him. We were in this kind of little cave of a room, and you could sort of tell from the audio. But it was a great conversation. I wish we'd had a lot more time. You know, I'd love to pull the string on the action-reaction comment. I think that's pretty Newtonian. But I think where Bob is kind of in the same place where we are. And it's a journey. And I really, really, really appreciate his honesty. I mean, just the moment we had as two human beings talking about really what we do and how we look at failure in order to learn is worth $1 million. I won't forget this, and I hope you don't either. I really found Bob to be charming, super, super nice, and really sensitive. And he takes this work incredibly seriously. It's really important to him. And really, what more could you ask for? I don't know. I really want you to think about what Bob said, that your work is a calling. There's a lot to that. There just is. That's pretty much the podcast for today. I can't say anything more. I don't even know what else to say other than, you know, I hope you learned something new every single day, and I bet you did today. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.